The Heart of Happy Hollow, a collection of stories by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. The Lynching of Jube Benson. Gordon Fairfax's library held but three men, but the air was dense with clouds of smoke. The talk had drifted from one topic to another, much as the smoke wreaths had puffed, floated, and thinned away. Then Handan Gay, who was an ambitious young reporter, spoke of a lynching story in a recent magazine, and the matter of punishment without trial put new life into the conversation.
"I should like to see a real lynching," said Gay rather callously. "Well, I should hardly express it that way," said Fairfax. "But if a real live lynching were to come my way, I should not avoid it."
"I should," spoke the other from the depths of his chair, where he had been puffing in moody silence.
Judged by his hair, which was freely sprinkled with gray, the speaker might have been a man of 45 or 50, but his face, though lined and serious, was youthful, the face of a man hardly past 30.
"What, you, Dr. Melville? Why, I thought that you physicians wouldn't weaken at anything."
"I have seen one such affair," said the doctor gravely. "In fact, I took a prominent part in it."
"Well, tell us about it,"
said the reporter, feeling for his pencil and notebook, which he was, nevertheless, careful to hide from the speaker. The men drew their chairs eagerly up to the doctor's, but for a minute he did not seem to see them, but sat gazing abstractedly into the fire. Then he took a long draw upon his cigar and began.
"I can see it all very vividly now. It was in the summertime, and about 7 years ago. I was practicing at the time down in the little town of Bradford. It was a small and primitive place, just the location for an impecunious medical man recently out of college. In lieu of a regular office, I attended to business in the first of 2 rooms which I had rented from Hiram Daly, one of the more prosperous of the townsmen. Here I boarded, and here also came my patients, white and black, whites from every section and blacks from Niggertown, as the west portion of the place was called. The people about me were most of them coarse and rough, but they were simple and generous, and as time passed on, I had about abandoned my intention of seeking distinction in wider fields and determined to settle into the place of a modest country doctor. This was rather a strange conclusion for a young man to arrive at, and I will not deny that the presence in the house of my host's beautiful young daughter Annie had something to do with my decision. She was a beautiful young girl of 17 or 18, and very far superior to her surroundings. She had a native grace and a pleasing way about her that made everybody that came under her spell her abject slave. White and black, who knew her, loved her, and none, I thought, more deeply and respectfully than Jube Benson, the black man of all work about the place. He was a fellow whom everybody trusted, and apparently steady-going, grinning sort, as we used to call him. Well, he was completely under Miss Annie's thumb, and would fetch and carry for her like a faithful dog. As soon as he saw that I began to care for Annie, and anybody could see that, he transferred some of his allegiance to me, and became my faithful servitor also. Never did a man have a more devoted adherent in his wooing than did I, and many a one of Annie's tasks, which he volunteered to do, gave her an extra hour with me. You can imagine that I liked the boy, and you need not wonder any more that as both wooing and my practice waxed apace, I was content to give up my great ambitions and stay just where I was. It wasn't a very pleasant thing, then, to have an epidemic of typhoid break out in the town that kept me going so that I hardly had time for the courting that a fellow wants to carry on with his sweetheart while he's still young enough to call her his girl. I fumed, but duty was duty, and I kept to my work night and day. It was now that Jube proved how invaluable he was as a coadjutor. He not only took messages to Annie, but brought sometimes little ones from her to me. And he would tell me little secret things that he had overheard her say that made me throb with joy and swear at him for repeating his mistress's conversation. But best of all, Jube was a perfect Cerberus, and no one on earth could have been more effective in keeping away or deluding the other young fellows who visited the Dailies. He would tell me of it afterwards, chuckling softly to himself. "And, Doctor, I say to Mr. Hemp Stevens, 'Excuse us, Mr. Stevens, but Miss Annie, she des gone out,' and then he go out of the gate looking mighty lonesome. Well, when Sam Elkins come, I say, 'Shh, Mr. Elkins, Miss Annie, she done tucked down.' And he say, 'What, Jube, you don't reckon hit the—' Then he stop and look scared, and I say, "I feared it is, Mr. Elkins," and checks my head. Easy solemn. He goes out of the gate looking like his best friend done died, and all the time Miss Annie behind the curtain over the porch there's a laughing fit to kill. Yeah. Jube was a most admirable liar, but what could I do? He knew that I was a young fool of a hypocrite, and when I would rebuke him for these deceptions, he would give way and roll on the floor in an excess of delightful laughter until from very contagion I had to join him. Well, there was no need of my preaching when there had been no beginning to his repentance, and when there must ensue a continuance of his wrongdoing. The thing went on for over 3 months, and then poof, I was down like a shot. My patients were nearly all up, but the reaction from overwork made me an easy victim of the lurking germs. Then Jube loomed up as a nurse. He put everyone else aside, and with the doctor, a friend of mine from a neighboring town, took entire charge of me. Even Annie herself was put aside, and I was cared for as tenderly as a baby. Tom, that was my physician and friend, told me all about it afterwards with tears in his eyes. Only he was a big, blunt man, and his expressions did not convey all that he meant. He told me how my nigger had nursed me as if I were a sick kitten, and he my mother. Oh, of how fiercely he guarded his right to be the sole one to do for me, as he called it, and how when the crisis came, he hovered, weeping but hopeful, at my bedside until it was safely past, when they drove him weak and exhausted from the room. As for me, I knew little about it at the time and cared less. I was too busy in my fight with death. To my chimerical vision, there was only a black but gentle demon that came and went, alternating with a white fairy who would insist on coming in on her head, growing larger and larger and then dissolving. But the pathos and devotion in the story lost nothing in my blunt friend's telling. It was during the period of a long convalescence, however, that I came to know my humble ally as he really was, devoted to the point of abjectness. There were times when, for very shame at his goodness to me, I would beg him to go away, to do something else. He would go, but before I had time to realize that I was not being ministered to, he would be back at my side, grinning and a-pottering just the same. He manufactured duties for the joy of performing them. He pretended to see desires in me that I never had, because he liked to pander to them. And when I became entirely exasperated and ripped out a good round oath, he chuckled with the remark, "Dad, now, you surely is getting well. Never did hear a man anywhere nigh Jones show cuss like that." Why, I grew to love him. Love him, oh, yes, I loved him as well. Ah, what am I saying? All human love and gratitude are damn poor things. Excuse me, gentlemen. This isn't a pleasant story. The truth is usually a nasty thing to stand. It was not 6 months after that that my friendship to Jube, which he had been at such great pains to win, was put to too severe a test. It was in the summer time again, and his business was slack. I'd ridden over to see my friend, Dr. Tom. I'd spent a good part of the day there, and it was past 4 o'clock when I rode leisurely into Bradford. I was in a particularly joyous mood, and no premonition of the impending catastrophe oppressed me. No sense of sorrow, present or to come, forced itself upon me, even when I saw men hurrying through the almost deserted streets. When I got within sight of my home and saw a crowd surrounding it, I was only interested sufficiently to spur my horse into a jog trot, which brought me up to the throng, when something in the sullen, settled horror in the men's face gave me a sudden sick thrill. They whispered a word to me, and without a thought, save for Annie, the girl who had been so surely grown into my heart, I leaped from the saddle and tore my way through the people to the house. It was Annie. Poor girl, bruised and bleeding, her face and dress torn from struggling. They had gathered round her with white faces, and oh, with what terrible patience they were trying to gain from her fluttering lips the name of her murderer. They made way for me, and I knelt at her side. She was beyond my skill, and my will merged with theirs. One thought was in our minds. "Who?" I asked. Her eyes half opened. "That black—" She fell back in my arms, dead. We turned and looked at each other. The mother had broken down and was weeping, but the face of the father was like iron. "It is enough," he said. "Jube has disappeared." He went to the door and said to the expectant crowd, "She's dead." I heard the angry roar without swelling up like the noise of a flood, and then I heard the sudden movement of many feet as the men separated into searching parties,
and laying the dead girl back upon her couch, I took my rifle and went out to join them. As if by intuition the knowledge had passed among the men that Jube Benson had disappeared, and he by common consent was to be the object of our search. Fully a dozen of the citizens had seen him hastening toward the woods and noted his skulking air, but as he had grinned in his old good-natured way, they had at the time thought nothing of it. Now, however, the diabolical reason of his slyness was apparent. He had been shrewd enough to disarm suspicion, and by now was far away. Even Mrs. Daly, who was visiting with a neighbor, had seen him stepping out by a back way, and had said with a laugh, "I reckon that black rascal's a-running off somewhere." Oh, if she had only known. "To the woods! To the woods!" That was the cry, and away we went, each with the determination not to shoot, but to bring the culprit alive into town and then to deal with him as his crime deserved. I cannot describe the feelings I experienced as I went out that night to beat the woods for this human tiger. My heart smoldered within me like a coal, and I went forward under the impulse of a will that was half my own and half some more malignant power. My throat throbbed dryly, but water nor whiskey would not have quenched my thirst. The thought has come to me since that now I could interpret the panther's desire for blood and sympathize with it. But then I thought nothing. I simply went forward and watched. Watched with burning eyes for a familiar form that I had looked for as often before with such different emotions. Luck, or ill luck, which you will, was with our party, and just as dawn was gray in the sky, we came upon our quarry crouched in the corner of a fence. It was only half light, and we might have passed, but my eyes had caught sight of him, and I raised a cry. We leveled our guns, and he rose and came toward us. "I thought you won't go on see me," he said sullenly. "I didn't mean no harm." "Harm?" Some of the men took the word up with oaths. Others were ominously silent. We gathered round him like hungry beasts, and I began to see terror dawning in his eyes. He turned to me. "I's mighty glad you's here, Doc," he said. "You ain't go on let him whop me." "Whip you, you hound," I said. "I'm going to see you hanged." And in the excess of my passion, I struck him full on the mouth. He made a motion as if to resent the blow against even such great odds, but controlled himself. "Why, doctor," he exclaimed in the saddest voice I've ever heard. "Why, doctor, I ain't stole nothing of yourn, and I was coming back. I only went off to see my gal Lucy over to Descender." "You lie," I said, and my hands were busy helping the others bind him upon a horse. Why did I do it? I don't know. A false education, I reckon. One false from the beginning. I saw his black face glooming there in the half-light, and I can only think of him as a monster. It's tradition. At first I was told that the black man would catch me, and when I got over that, they taught me that the devil was black, and when I had recovered from the sickness of that belief, here were Jube and his fellows with faces of menacing blackness. There was only one conclusion. The black man stood for all the powers of evil, the result of whose machinations had been gathering in my mind from childhood up. But this has nothing to do with what happened. After firing a few shots to announce our capture, we rode back into town with Jube. The ingathering parties from all directions met us as we made our way up to the house. All was very quiet and orderly. There was no doubt that it was, as the papers would have said, a gathering of the best citizens. It was a gathering of stern, determined men, bent on a terrible vengeance. We took Jube into the house, into the room where the corpse lay. At sight of it, he gave a scream like an animal's, and his face went the color of storm-blown water. This was enough to condemn him. We divined rather than heard his cry of, "Miss Ann, Miss Ann! Oh, my God, Doc, you don't think I'd done it?" Hungry hands were ready. We hurried him out into the yard. A rope was ready. A tree was at hand. Well, that part was the least of it, save that Hiram Daly stepped aside to let me be the first to pull upon the rope. It was lax at first, then it tightened, and I felt the quivering soft weight resist my muscles. Other hands joined, and Jube swung off his feet. No one was masked. We knew each other. Not even the culprit's face was covered, and the last I remember of him as he went into the air was a look of sad reproach that will remain with me until I meet him face to face again. We were tying the end of the rope to a tree where the dead man might hang as a warning to his fellows when a terrible cry chilled us to the marrow. "Cut him down! Cut him down! He ain't guilty! We got the one! Cut him down, for God's sake! Here's the man! We found him hiding in the barn!" Jube's brother Ben and another Negro came rushing toward us, half dragging, half carrying a miserable-looking wretch between them.
Someone cut the rope and Jube dropped lifeless to the ground. "Oh, my God! He's dead! He's dead!" wailed the brother. But with blazing eyes, he brought his captive into the center of the group, and we saw in the full light the scratched face of Tom Skinner, the worst white ruffian in the town. But the face we saw was not as we were accustomed to see it, merely smeared with dirt. It was blackened to imitate a Negro's. God forgive me, I could not wait to try to resuscitate Jube. I knew he was already past help, so I rushed into the house and to the dead girl's side. In the excitement, they had not yet washed or laid her out. Carefully, I searched underneath her broken fingernails. There was skin there. I took it out, the little curled pieces, and went with it to my office. There, determinedly, I examined it under a powerful glass and read my own doom. It was the skin of a white man, and in it were embedded strands of short brown hair or beard. How I went out to tell the waiting crowd, I do not know. For something kept crying in my ears, "Blood guilty! Blood guilty!" The men went away, stricken into silence and awe. The new prisoner attempted neither denial nor plea. When they were gone, I would have helped Ben carry his brother in, but he waved me away fiercely. "You helped murder my brother! You! That was his friend! Go away! Go away! I'll take him home myself." I could only respect his wish, and he and his comrade took up the dead man and between them bore him up the street on which the sun was now shining full. I saw the few men who had not skulked indoors uncover as they passed, and I stood there between the two murdered ones, while all the while something in my ears kept crying, "Blood guilty! Blood guilty!" The doctor's head dropped into his hands, and he sat for some time in silence, which was broken by neither of the men. Then he rose, saying, "Gentlemen, that was my last lynching." The end of The Lynching of Jube Benson. A story by Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.